Welcome to episode 8 of the Serious About Security podcast for Friday, May 25th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SIRIUS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at SIRIUS.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP.
Well, we have relatively few announcements for this episode. Summer is in full swing here at Purdue, and that typically means that the campus is a quiet place, minus the construction noise. Consequently, we have no upcoming events to announce, except
the next Greater Lafayette Security Professionals monthly meeting will take place on June 14th. As of yet, we have no topics. If you're interested in presenting some interesting work or new security trend or technology, please contact Keith.
In news today, we've got an update for Google Chrome. It was updated to 19.0.1084.52 on May 23rd. Apple released a security update for Leopard on May 14th. They also released a flashback removal tool update on May 14th, and they updated QuickTime to 7.2 for Windows 7, Vista, XP, Service Pack 2, or later on May 15th. It fixes quite a few vulnerabilities with the Windows version of QuickTime, and the Mac systems were updated via the Apple updates. And that is the news. So now we'll move over to articles, and I have the first article this week. My article is about IBM banning the use of Siri on the iPhone because they were concerned about data leaks. Basically, what they cited was the policy for that Apple has on the use of Siri is not very clear on what they do with the data once it is transmitted to their server for processing. IBM was concerned about what happened to that data because they were not clear at all on in their policies on if the data was kept, what happened to it, and when it was destroyed. So I just thought this was an interesting article from a privacy perspective.
I think a lot of people forget that, and Siri is just one example. I mean, you could take web searches as another example of a way of extracting data from an organization. And the reason I say that is if you have a Google account and you're logged into it, anytime you type something in that search box, that's then stored in your search history, which you can then pull up later. And if you can pull it up later, that means Google has stored it somewhere and they could pull it up later. And so why are search results similar to Siri? Well, not necessarily, but if you're doing research for a future product and you might want to go out on the web and look for some content, you would be, in a way, telegraphing what your company is looking for, what its interests are. And if you had a whole group of employees doing something similar, then that's a good way for somebody to do some competitive intelligence gathering on what you may be up to. Now, we all hope and trust that Google will follow its principle of do no evil, or do not be evil, or whatever it is. But we've seen in the past that they have a little questionable area in that a blind spot, if you will, to some ethical issues.
Well, what I found interesting about this article was how Siri uses the data. The article describes that, you know, you ask Siri a question like, what's on my calendar today, or what's Keith's phone number? It sounds like that information is actually all transmitted to Apple. And that's the alarming part to me. I understand the capturing of the questions and the generic things like how old is Chuck Norris or something. You know, if you ask Siri that, I can understand it kind of going out there and gathering from this large database. But if I'm asking Siri, what's on my calendar today, does that information really need to travel up to Apple? So I think IBM's got a right to be concerned. I guess my hopes is I'm not overly concerned about this because, as you described, Keith, a lot of things share information in this way. But maybe by IBM kind of making a stand here, Apple will be a little more clear about how they're using that data. I'm hoping that they're randomizing it or encrypting it, or they're not making it so that there's this large database of the global contact address book, if you will, that says, here's all Keith's contacts, and here's all Preston's contacts, and here's all Mike's contacts.
Well, I think the biggest concern by IBM is that there is no policy, specific policy on what happens to the data. Google has policies, lots and lots and lots and lots of policies on what they do with their data. And I mean, obviously, you trust Google to follow their policies, but they do have a policy on what they do with their data after a certain amount of time and stuff like that. And I don't think Apple has that sort of policy. And I think IBM's kind of making a stand saying, until you get this policy in place, we're not going to allow the use of your software.
Going to policies, I think Google has attempted to simplify policies. And it used to be that every product they had a separate policy, and now they've tried to consolidate those where they can. So they actually have fewer, but more unified policy. I would disagree about Apple's policies because I don't know if you've read their policies on any product they have nowadays, especially iTunes. There are voluminous in legal information. And even the iPhone 4S and all the other devices have very long license agreements. Merely by opening the box that holds a phone, you're subject to those. And so policy-wise, I think Apple, while vague in what they do with the information, I don't know if it's any different than Google's use of your information if you read it the way it's stated. The other thing is, if IBM is going to ban Siri or iPads as devices that collect voice information, well, they also have to ban Google as a search engine, because now if you have the Google Talk plugin and you go to the Google search page, you can actually speak the search term you're looking for. And it does not translate that locally on your device. It's all sent up to the cloud somewhere, translated, and then your results come back, just like Siri does, although not as sophisticated, let's say. So if IBM is going to take a stand on Siri, it's got to take a stand on Google search as well. Not just because of the content you're searching for, but because of this whole voice interaction. If that's their concern, they need to be looking at a lot of other devices, including a lot of the Android services that provide something similar. So when I'm driving and I pull up my Android phone, I'm not typing. I'm actually talking to it, and it does, just like Siri, go up to the cloud, get translated, and I get some results back. So.
Well, actually, Keith, I hope that you're not pulling out your Android device while you're driving and speaking into it and having it send a text message, as we know that texting and driving is not permitted in this state. So I'm just giving you a hard time. I don't know. You make very good points. And the voice itself, is that the majority of the concern here as well? Because if it's what's being searched on, I mean, that's been taking place for a long time now, those search terms, as you described, the way Google collects that. So what is it about Siri that IBM really is getting worried over? Is the fact that it's capturing my voice, making these requests as well? Because I didn't really get the sense from the article that it was so much on the fact that it was voice-based, more of the way it was conducting the search. And as you've already pointed out, many other things do the same things.
Well, I think one of their concerns is that you can use Siri to write a email or a text message, and they have potentially confidential information that people could send via an email, and they're storing these emails on somewhere else, and they don't have any idea on what's going to happen to them.
I think the bigger issue here is that. At one time, when you bought a phone, all the data stayed on that phone. The only thing that went off was whatever communications went over the cellular network. But now that we have smartphones, the data somewhat is stored locally, but most of it is stored in the cloud somewhere, especially on an Android device and an iPhone, where most of the services you have are either stored on Google's cloud services or on Apple's iCloud. And so if companies are going to take have a concern about these devices, they need to have concern not just with iPhones, but with any device. And that includes tablets, including any special purpose device that they're going to have in their organization. So for one company to come out and say, that Apple iPhone is a security risk, that's a very small view of the world. And I think if they're going to take a stand like that, then they need to go back and say, you know what? I got this Android thing. It does the same thing. I've got these tablets. They're all doing the same thing. This proprietary information that my company is developing is not stored within my company anymore. And so their policy should be, let's look at how we can use the cloud or maybe specific cloud providers that provide certain security guarantees and not just ban products outright without taking a bigger picture look and saying, oh, yeah, I got all these other issues with all these other products I didn't even think about. This is kind of a narrow view, in my opinion. It's like pointing out the obvious market leader but not considering the fact that there are a lot of other products that do something very similar or more intrusive, if you will. So it's kind of a short-sighted view.
Well, yeah, and regarding the policy as well, this is going to be one of those I think that's difficult to enforce. Obviously, you can say as a company, IBM can say, while you're in the office, you will not use Siri on your iPhones and your iPads. However, when you are at home or when you are at Starbucks or wherever you may be, if you use Siri, if you still have data on your phone, any work-related data, the potential is that some of that could maybe get carried up into the cloud there. So can IBM really say you can't use Siri at all on this personal device that you own? I mean, they can enforce it while you're in the office, but the office has really changed nowadays as well. I mean, there's the virtual office as well. What if you work from home? What constitutes fair use of your personal device or not? You know, because pretty much the difference between the iPhone 4 and 4S is Siri, and it's like a $100 difference. So people who invest in that probably want to be able to use it.
Okay, well, we'll move on to the next article now, and this one is Keith's.
Yeah, the article is related to a system administration tool known as Sudo, or Sudo, depending on who you speak to. And this points out a security hole that was created due to a missing line in the programming code. And I thought it was interesting because having written C programs before and specifically switch statements, I've done something similar to this. And if you understand how C works, if you're missing this particular line, and it's called a break line, which kind of interrupts the flow of execution so that it jumps out of that C statement or a switch statement, if you leave it out, it will continue on to the next part of the code. And so this particular problem was dealing with checking to see if in the configuration file that the system in which the sudo command was run was listed as a system to be allowed execution. And first it checks IPv4 addresses and then it checks IPv6. Well, in between the checks between IPv4 and IPv6 was no break statement. So essentially, if you had configured sudo to say only allow sudo to run on these particular machines, when this check occurred, if there was a failure indicating that the system was not allowed under the IPv4 netmask check, there was no break line to interrupt that execution. So what it would do is it would say, well, no, you're an IPv4 system that's not allowed. And instead of returning, it would continue on and check to see if it was IPv6 system that would be allowed, which in this case didn't apply, so the execution would continue. Essentially, this meant that even if you had put in a statement to disallow execution on a particular range of machines, that was effectively ignored. And so people could run the sudo command on machines that they weren't allowed to do. And the only patch for this problem was just a very simple re-add in the break statement that was missing. So I found this was interesting because the patch was very simple. the flaw was very trivial. The error I've done multiple times myself. I doubt that that whoever was in the code at the time intentionally did this. I think it's more likely that the line got deleted and then it was missed and no one noticed. It passed all the tests. There probably are some C programmers out there. I don't believe that the sudo programmers are probably in this class, but there probably are some C programmers who don't understand how C switch statements work, especially if there's a break missing. In fact, I think I've written code before that took advantage of not having the break statement in there. I don't recommend doing that. It's not good programming, but it can be done. Essentially, this is a huge problem over a very trivial line and some software. I thought it was interesting and worth talking about briefly.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, Keith, as a software developer, it's a pretty easy mistake to make, and I'm certain I've made it before in programming as well. These types of errors are, there's multitudes of ways you can make these small mistakes in software. The lesson we can all learn from it is really having a very good verification process in place. I'm assuming that this software probably went through some kind of formal review, and I can see where even experienced developers could look at it and maybe overlook it, but I wonder if that really happened, if they had sort of a code review in place or some kind of check-in process in place. Maybe they had some verification procedures that they run against the code, some bench tests, if you will, that make sure the code behaves this way in this condition and this way in another condition. I mean, for example, a good unit test on this particular example would be to run it and say, I'm an unauthorized user. I should not be able to run sudo. Does it work? Now, that's pretty easy to say after the fact, because we saw it fail in this one case and we have no idea how many lines of code was in this particular software. I mean, it could have been thousands, it could have been millions of lines of code. But having some unit tests in place that maybe could catch these kinds of conditions would be a good thing. But again, unit tests, it's very difficult to get 100% coverage across the board. Even though if you did all those things, this kind of mistake could still happen, I think it would really lessen the likelihood. And I think that's kind of the takeaway is having kind of a formal review process in place before you release software is a very good thing because it is really easy. That one line of code changed everything in this case.
I haven't reviewed sudo's tests, so I don't actually know their extensiveness of how much they test or if they do. But the other issue is that this is an open source project, and often any development that goes into it is contributed for free by developers who have an itch to scratch, if you will. And so sometimes testing falls by the wayside. There's a lot of there's a fair number, let's say, open source projects that have no tests. They're kind of functionally tested by the users who download and install it. But that's not quite when you want to do testing, and especially on security critical services and tools like sudo. So I would hope that perhaps in the future a set of really good tests might be incorporated into the package, and if they're not there already. And it could be one of these test cases that you didn't write a test for and now you do. So hopefully that gets integrated in.
Yeah, and one thing I do on one of my open source projects is when a lot of times there's the option of kind of grabbing the established release version that's been around for a little while, and then there's sort of these beta releases or control development versions, and I tend to shy away from those for this very reason. As you described, the users are kind of the functionality test, and if it's been, if that module or that software has been out there for a couple months or longer, then hopefully these types of things have been uncovered, whereas the development version or the beta version is kind of that cutting edge, and I prefer to, and I've heard it referred to as the bleeding edge, and I prefer to stay just a little bit off that edge because I don't want to be the first one to encounter this kind of issue.
Well, I think this I mean, this specific issue highlights the value, how valuable unit testing is, and also some sort of integrated development environment, which would probably potentially catch an error like this. I can't speak for all open source developers, but I know that a lot of them are very particular in the type of environment they use, and typically. By particular, I mean they go very, very simple to the level of using like VI or something like that without really any error checking or anything like that. And an integrated development environment probably would have at least warned a user, hey, you forgot to put a break statement here. Are you sure you want to do that? So I think that makes that this highlights that problem.
Yeah, I'm not sure though, and I don't use IDEs a lot, but I wonder if IDEs would catch it, because it's valid not to have a break statement. I mean, it's allowed in the code. So, anyways.
Well, typically they you know, these common mistakes they will catch. Now I don't know either. I've never used one for C, so I don't know. But I'm guessing it would.
It might be one of those tweakable options. You know, warn me what break statements are missing. Anyways, the next article is another one that we talked about previously, and Mike had mentioned several episodes back about the Google Chrome contest at CANSEC West 2012. And if we recall our history here, Google decided not to participate in Pwn to Own, primarily because the contestants weren't required to reveal how they discovered exploits or what exploits were used to actually win the contest. And so this article is related to a posting on Google's Chromium blog that talks about how the first winner, Pinkie Pie, was able to hack Google Chrome. And it turns out there's not one bug, but six bugs used to do this. And each bug was used to exploit another bug in another part of the system. So it's kind of a cascading series of bugs that were that allowed Pinkie Pie to actually win the contest here. And so I thought it was interesting, primarily because when we talk about Google Chrome, we talk about a lot of the sandboxing capabilities and some of the security features that Google has designed into this browser. And so in order to exploit it, you can see that there's a significant amount of work needed to do that. And so so it's not just one bug won't get you enough to hack this browser. You've got to have a series of them in some cases, and then figure out how to tie them all together so that you can exploit various aspects of these problems to get you a higher level of access, or to get you to another bug, which gets you to another bug, which gets you to another bug, into a way that you can actually exploit the system. And so this is very, very complicated series of bugs, and the research involved just figuring this stuff out must have been very significant. So this was interesting. Pinkie Pie was the winner of the contest, was able to do this first. But what's more interesting is the runner-up used 10 bugs to exploit the browser. So I thought this was a very interesting article. Hopefully they'll post an update, maybe we can talk about it next time, that talks about the 10 bugs used by the other contestant.
Yeah, and I think it's a great illustration of how these exploits happen, and it's something important for software developers to keep in mind. And I'm guilty of this myself. I tend to think of exploits against my system as being kind of like, I got this big hole here and it's just one thing I need to patch. When in reality, I think a lot of times it happens in these sequences. It's six bugs, it's 10 bugs, it's a series of things. One bug gets you this ability, which then leads to an ability to exploit another bug, and you kind of chain them all together and ultimately get an exploit to occur. So I think that's one of the challenges in developing software, is kind of being aware of all the different areas your software can fail. And it's really difficult, because you have to think of you almost always design it in mind with the intention of how it's going to be used correctly, but you really have to force yourself to think of what about anything outside of that? How, you know, if I want it to work for these three conditions, how do I make sure it doesn't work for any other condition other than those threes, and really locking it down? And as we just discussed in the last article, you know, one line of code can change everything from, you know, I'm only allowing these three good conditions to now I'm allowing a plethora of other conditions to occur. And it may be that that one bug doesn't necessarily break your system, but if that bug is combined with another bug and combined with another bug, then you may have a serious problem.
That's a good point, that a lot of times when programmers have a series of bugs in their inbox to fix, some of the minor ones or some that are considered trivial get the least amount of effort to get corrected. And sometimes it's like, well, those are minor bugs, they're corner cases, no one's going to find those, so we're just going to move on with adding features or whatever. We don't need to fix those bugs. Here might be a case of, here's a reason why you want to at least consider them a little more seriously before you dismiss them as being too trivial to exploit.
Well, the one thing I will say is I really commend Google for taking the approach that they did, that running the contest in the manner that they did, they were able to find out exactly how they were exploited. So I think this is a great model that they're following by breaking out and saying, you know what, we need to know how the software is being broken so that we can fix it. I think that's a great approach to take. And I really look forward to hearing part two, a series of 10 bugs, how those came together. And hopefully Google will continue this stance in the future. I think this is great. In fact, I think they should, you know, if they're in the position, they should up the ante, because, you know, the more money they're willing to offer, the harder hackers out there are going to work to break their software.
Yeah, they might be a good test case for whether this paying for bugs process works as well as we hoped. Although, unfortunately, there's a market developing for unknown bugs, which also government agencies are also willing to pay money for, which is a more concerning issue to me.
Well, I think one more thing is I don't think any of these six bugs were minor bugs. They were all major bugs. So, you know, they allowed privilege escalation. They allowed code injection. They allowed memory overflows. They were all... He exploited six major bugs in order to bypass essentially all the access restrictions he needed to do a drive-by install. So I don't know if any of these were known, how he found any of these, but there were six major bugs in Chrome that he exploited.
Okay. We're going to move on to the last article of this episode, and this one is from me, and it is on Yahoo Access. So Yahoo released Access just the other day as a plugin for browsers, and what it essentially allows you to do is sync up your session with an iPhone or an iPad. So if I'm using this plugin in Chrome, let's say this Access plugin, I can start up a session and I can have some tabs open and be doing some work, and then I can go to a meeting, grab my iPad, and with this app, this Access app, I can say I want to resume that session, and I can see all those tabs that were open, and I kind of take over and continue surfing those sites that I was surfing. So I thought this was interesting that Yahoo was bringing out this browser extension. Initial reports were it was bringing out a new browser, but it really is more of a plug-in for existing browsers, and then it has the iPhone and the iPad apps. But shortly after releasing this extension, they were a security report came out almost instantly, and what it did was it described the fact that they had bundled their private key inside the Chrome extension. So essentially, with that private key, anyone that could get their hands on it could then sign apps as if they were Yahoo. So of course, Yahoo it quickly revoked that certificate and issued a new one. But it's It was just kind of alarming that, I mean, basically within 24 hours of this new product being released, that this security implication was already found. So I just thought that was – I thought this would be an interesting one to talk about because, you know, we're hearing from Yahoo. We actually were talking prior to the start of the podcast how many of us actually use Yahoo for searching anymore, and not too much. So, you know, this is clearly an attempt from Yahoo to kind of gain some ground back. And, you know, they come out of the gate and immediately there's a security implication. So definitely this is damaging for them. You know, kind of like to talk about the process here. You know, what could Yahoo have done differently to avoid this? I mean, obviously the simple answer is don't, you know, protect. They should have been protecting their private key in a better manner. But I also wonder, I mean, when I look at this incident, I go, was it ready for prime time? Did they release this product? You know, were they following a time schedule and said, we have to release the product on this date? We really want to get this out the door. And did they not do due diligence, or is this just one of those things that snuck through on them? You know, they felt they were ready. They thought they had everything in place. And then, you know, it just turns out that this bug was just kind of sitting there for them.
I think it's more likely that they did not handle their keys properly. And that might include that maybe they generated a private key and checked it into their source repository. And then when it was time to ship code, they checked out all the code, including their private key, bundled it all up, and sent it out. So I think it's probably something as simple as that, but even something simple as that was a goof in their release process, and nobody caught it until it was already out there.
Well, I think going back to something Google did with Chrome, they decided to strip out the online replication system from Chrome. So in addition to this affecting Yahoo, this also affected Google because they essentially had to update Chrome in order to take Yahoo's private key out of the Chrome browser in order for it to prevent others from, you know, creating false extensions as Yahoo.
Yes, and by doing that, though, while Chrome had to issue an update, did that allow, in a way that allowed them to respond more quickly to this type of error as well, correct? If I'm understanding how that all works, that instead of it being where the user's browser would have to check the online instance, basically their Chrome browser would just automatically update, and that certificate would have been revoked automatically for them.
If I remember right, I think while Chrome stops checking using the online certificate status protocol and checking for revoked certificates, I thought they created a local cache of revoked certificates that were managed by Google. I thought that was the process that they had switched to, mostly for performance reasons. But regardless of how they had to correct that, I think it's a matter that the release process that Yahoo has used bundled something they shouldn't. That might have been a simple mistake. It might have been something they checked out all the code and that just happened to be part of the bundle. It could be some junior person on the team who was responsible for that and didn't see the ramifications of including a private key in the code that was released. You know, we really don't know. And certainly Yahoo has not spoken about this issue. So it's hard to say what they did, but the implications are that, like Mike said, somebody could go and take that private key and start signing other apps and passing them off as Yahoo apps. It certainly could be a way of somebody creating a malicious app and bundling it up under the Yahoo, assigned as a Yahoo extension or application or what have you. And we don't know if this private key was limited only to use with Access or if it was used by quite a few other Yahoo products. So if it were a private key for a very major developer signing key, then this could have significant ramifications for all their other products that they have as well.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how it unfolds, definitely. But I thought it was interesting to mention because it seemed like I was starting to see a little bit of buzz about this Yahoo Access, and really within a day, then I saw the security vulnerability. So at least what worked in Yahoo's favor in this case was the security researcher, I believe, who found it, came forward and described it. I do believe he blogged about it and talked about it, but he also contacted Yahoo and let them know about it. So this wasn't an incident where someone uncovered it and tried to use it for their own private, personal gain. Because as you said, they could have signed some extensions. I mean, even if it was just limited to signing as Access or just signing for the Chrome browser, that could have had some major ramifications. So, on the upside, even though it went shortly along with the product release, it really, I think, narrowed the window of opportunity for it to be used maliciously against them.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it was pretty trivial to find this private key within the software itself. I mean, on the article page, it shows a screenshot of an application that was used to do it, and I mean, this is just basically public information with the images and the XML files that are basically stored within the file itself. So I think it was a fairly trivial thing to find, which is good and bad. I mean, it's good that the person came forward and didn't try and do anything, malicious with it. And it was discovered within, what, 12 hours or less of its release. So that's good. So that is going to be our podcast for today. I wanted to thank the hosts, Keith Watson and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.